Welcome to Trust the Journey. I'm Melanie Curtis.
And I'm Jason Maledsky.
Thank you, legit, for joining us today.
Yeah, our mission is living and learning, laughing and loving together with you.
We're here to grow and contribute through our practice of openness, honesty, vulnerability, humility, and trust, trusting the entire journey.
Yeah, and on that journey, we often talk about plant medicines, psychedelics, and other avenues of healing. When we do, we are sharing for informational purposes only. We're not doctors or therapists, and we don't promote doing anything illegal.
Inside us all, we have a deep, powerful knowing. We encourage curiosity, healing, and exploration of this consciousness.
Damn straight. Together, our handle is trustthejourney.today. Individually, you can find her at melaniecurtis.com and me at jasonmaledsky.com.
Thank you all again so much for being with us. On to the show.
Okay, today we are super excited to welcome to the show Eric and Megan Alden. Eric has been on active duty with the U.S. military for 15 years. The majority of his service was in special operations with multiple combat deployments during each military career. Eric discovered the passion for skydiving and later teaching others to skydive as well. A self-diagnosed adrenaline addict, when he was not flying fast parachutes or chasing students through the air, he finds serenity riding motorcycles, traveling to new locations, and spending time in nature. Me too. His current mission in life is finding ways to help other veterans who are also struggling to fully come home from war, whether it's been months or years since their last combat deployment.
I love that. Thank you. Yeah, and then we also welcome Dr. Megan Alden. She is an emergency medicine and critical care doctor with 14 years of service in the Air Force, including three combat deployments focused on casualty evacuation. She's transitioning to civilian life, now pursuing a more values-aligned path for herself. As a relatively junior skydiver, she enjoys sharing her love for the sport as a coach. In her newfound spare time, she is pursuing expanded goals as a canopy pilot and body flyer. She hopes to leverage her knowledge of emergency response to improve safety on drop zones, sharing her experience to enhance emergency preparedness and response protocols. After experiencing a traumatic brain injury, TBI, and subsequent PTSD following a rocket attack in 2020, Megan developed a deep passion for enhancing performance in high-stakes environments. Driven by this experience, she's dedicated to promoting holistic approaches to optimize team effectiveness and individual well-being. With a heart for adventure and service, Megan is ready to embark on new challenges both in and out of the medical field. Megan and Eric, welcome.
Yeah, big welcome. Super excited to have you both here. It's great to see the smiling faces again. I'll give you guys a little backstory on how I got to know Eric and Megan. If you've been listening to the show for any time, you know that my former career was as a canopy pilot, professional athlete, and as a coach. And more recently, we had a national team training camp, and Eric was one of the participants in that camp. And during that camp, we got to know each other a lot better, really felt like we bonded and we had a great share, which was really special. And it made me, it inspired me to invite him on the show. And along with that was this wonderful presentation that came from Megan, which she just volunteered up to share with our team. And I felt it was so impactful and it was so on point for the Trusted Journey model that I wanted to have them both on here. So welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. We're excited to be here.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Oh yeah, yeah, I was just gonna say it just felt like one of those things where everything just, the universe aligned and things just happened the way they were supposed to. And yeah, it's very, very grateful to be here.
Agreed, yeah. I'm grateful for you stepping out and offering to help support on the journey there and being such a key player in the whole team camp, and I've been looking forward to seeing where that leads in the future.
Yeah, and
so,
I haven't
great to have you both on the show.
I haven't seen this presentation. I haven't heard it. I have heard how great it is and how excited I am about sharing it with the family and on our audience. And so, yeah, Megan and Eric, take it away. Like, how should we start? What should we start with?
I can go ahead and start. And I am understanding that the slides that we have will be made available to the listeners in the future, but those that are listening and not seeing the slides at the same time, we'll try to explain things as best we can so that you can follow along. I do have to start with a bit of a disclaimer, just to let everyone know that Eric and I are both active duty military, and anything we'll talk about is not the opinions of the military. It's our own opinions. As Melanie mentioned, I developed a bit of a passion, you could call it, for learning about the way that we perform in the world, somewhat by necessity. I was in Afghanistan in 2020 and was in an aircraft very close proximity to a 107 rocket round that exploded, and had a pretty severe TBI or concussion coming back. I came back and threw myself headlong into a critical care fellowship March 1st, 2020. And if anybody remembers that, it was just about the time that COVID was really starting to roll. And I was doing that fellowship in a center that was a referral center for respiratory patients that were failing, and one of the biggest ones in the country. I found myself struggling with symptoms of post-traumatic stress and having difficulty with sleep, concentration, things of that nature, and really sought some help to look into ways to really perform better in the work that I was doing. It was about a year and a half later and Jay, if you want to swap to the next slide,
sure.
Eric had been involved in a bit of an incident and kind of taught us how some of the lessons I had learned might expand to the bigger realm. Eric, do you want to share a little bit about that experience?
Sure. Yep. So a little bit of background on myself at the time. So I was, about halfway through my military career, I'd done, deployments pretty much every year for about, 10 straight years. And in between those deployments, constantly busy with various trainings. And so at the time of the incident, I was out instructing at a military skydiving course. And it was a very stressful course for everyone involved, students and instructors. And this particular jump, I was the jump master for the load, which is the person responsible for everyone else's safety on that whole airplane. It was at night, so we were jumping on night vision goggles. And I was jumping an unfamiliar parachute to me. And unfortunately, when I was coming in to land, just completely mistimed the flare of the parachute. So I essentially hit the ground at full speed without slowing down at all, and was injured pretty severely. I was unconscious for a little bit, kind of tumbled, knocked my night vision goggles off my helmet, just lying on the ground long enough that one of the instructors came out to me, and some of the other guys like legitimately were concerned that I, might be dead. It was a pretty severe crash. Ended up blowing out both my knees, couldn't really walk or stand without severe pain for months. And at the time I couldn't really understand how it happened because I was a relatively experienced skydiver. I was an instructor. I'd spent a lot of time using night vision goggles, so I didn't understand why all of a sudden my body failed to perform a relatively basic task. I don't know if you guys have any more questions or thoughts about any of that.
Wow, taking it in.
Yeah, I think we can definitely relate, as both Melanie and I have been pro skydivers our whole lives. That idea of, I have the skill set and how do I end up in this situation? The big why question, because I've certainly made very similar mistakes where I've completely missed key functions during a landing and ended up hurting myself as a result. And it's the kind of thing that you look back at and it's easier to understand post, but you're not always able to see it before it happens to you.
For sure. So, and I even hear it now. I mean, I know Eric's okay, and we're a couple of years later now, and I still, it's hard to hear. So we kind of looked at the same thing, a little bit of why these problems happen, and started to look at something that in the medical world we call a root cause analysis, essentially trying to line up all of the ways that the holes in the Swiss cheese lined up, so to speak, and the ways that as we added factors to the picture, it created a situation that was, these things were kind of almost bound to happen. Looking at adding up the environmental and really human factors that played a role, we started to kind of put together that the addition of night vision goggles to a first course as an instructor, first night jump as a jump master, all of these things start to build a cognitive load or a load on the brain that is just more than it can really handle. And so something that was a big takeaway for me throughout this experience was trying to understand how performance works and how stress plays a role in those things and how we can take control of the factors surrounding us to really have more control than we think about how we are performing at any given task. So for those that can see the slides, this is what we call in nerd speak a Yerkes-Dodson curve. For those that can't, it's a graph that compares how we perform under increasing amounts of stress. Essentially, under low stress environments, we're, as humans, a bit bored and tend to have the risk for being complacent. After that, there's a zone where we're really performing. And I really like to point out the fact that this is a zone. It is not a point where we are standing on top of the mountain and always performing at peak. There's a point where that is a thing that we tolerate fairly well and can operate in that zone to really perform at our best. And having knowledge of what exactly that peak is very difficult. And the challenge about that is that when we pass that peak performance zone of optimum amount of stress on the system, we reach a point where that performance actually starts to decrease. We fatigue, the system fails, people get injured, or in high stakes environments can kill people. So it became kind of one of my missions to try to sort out and share how we understand this a little bit better and how we help to understand ourselves in a way that allows us to prevent these things from happening.
Yeah, and Megan, I'll jump in for a second because the Swiss cheese lining up, the assessing an incident and really looking for what occurred, what led up to this incident, what were the factors at play. One of the things, and you guys I'm sure know this, but for those listening, one of the things that we say in skydiving is we say links in the chain. And so what were those links in the chain? How many of those things like piled on, or what extenuating circumstances or what stresses, to your point in this particular conversation, led to the load being too great such that the link in the chain broke, right? Like that's a thing. If you have two strong links, you know, it's a kind of a silly metaphor potentially, but it in assessing incidents, it is very, very common to see this where there is a multitude of things. It's unusual that it is one thing contributing to an incident. It's usually this happened and then this was the weather condition and then this was how I was feeling or what I was afraid of or whatever. And that is altogether collectively leads to the incident. So anyway, I just want to share that because I feel like it's a very important and useful piece of information for people, because this doesn't have to only be in skydiving. This can be in life and relationship and work as well.
Yeah, I'll jump in there for a second real quick. There's a rule of thumb that I've used in my career to help keep myself safe. And it's this three strikes, you're out kind of idea. It's like one new added variable is manageable by somebody who already has a developed skill set. Two new variables into the situation starts to put up a yellow flag that there's a warning sign that we're starting to have to juggle a lot of extra balls. And three is the for sure we're going to have something is going to go unplanned. There will be a change that we can't account for. And it doesn't mean it's going to mean tragedy. It just means that something's not going to go quite right like it's supposed to. And in the years of coaching people, if I give somebody a third variable or I let them take on a third variable, it almost always appears. I want to hear Eric's thoughts there because he was the one who had happened. So let's hear how it played out for you, Eric.
No, I absolutely agree with both your points. I will say for myself that, you know, looking back, there's also a few other factors. Like I think... you know, it's kind of embarrassing for me to say this now, but like arrogance played a factor. Like I, to that point in my both life, career, and as an athlete, I always had it. I was always like, cool, I'm just going to go do it and I'm going to figure it out and it's going to be awesome. And up until that point, it was. So I think there was an aspect of arrogance where I thought like, I can handle it. Sure. And so I didn't accurately assess all of those risk factors, because I do think even now looking back, I could have handled any one of those risk factors individually, but the combination of them together was obviously too much at the time. And I think where this kind of ties in with the rest of Megan's presentation is that I also did not have an accurate assessment of where I was mentally, emotionally, physically, just at a baseline coming into it. So due to, you know, 10 back-to-back combat deployments and just constantly being in the red, stressed out 24/7, just sitting on a couch watching TV, now you throw all these risk factors on top of it and, it, you know, catastrophic injury happens. So I think that's what I really want to focus on with this presentation is how do we make sure that we are bringing our best selves to whatever we do as much as possible, so that we're not already starting behind the curve before we even add additional factors.
I love where you're going with that, the whole concept of being able to assess your baseline before even adding variable to it is something that a skill set that most of us don't leverage or don't train very often. So that's a huge, huge point.
Agreed.
So true. And I really like what Jay is bringing forward about having a concrete number and a way to keep ourselves accountable. There actually is some data behind that, even in the medical world for us, about how if we don't have a number, we don't have a way to keep ourselves accountable to that, that we tend to kind of slide into the gray and just not recognize those factors. So I love that you bring that up.
There's some real advantage to that too. Something that I've leveraged a lot in my own personal training is I will intentionally add in a fourth factor during training environments where I know that I'm in a contained environment that's well within familiarity to myself. And that's when I'll intentionally bring in that fourth factor in order to stress the system, just like working out at the gym and pushing to the breaking point. And that operation allows me to open up the periphery vision by when I remove that fourth factor again. So whether it have been in canopy piloting or just recently in paragliding, I was doing the same thing where I'm like, I'm overloading myself. I have a radio, a headset going on and a Vario all beep, three different sources of audio input, plus the wind is blowing in my ear. So four different sources of audio input and having to sort through all that literal noise to figure out like which one deserves my attention right now. How do I prioritize what I need to be paying attention to? Really powerful stuff. Let's jump back into it.
So it's a perfect lead in to the kind of next topic, if you will, is how do we, I really got kind of nerdy and I'll take a few minutes to kind of give us all a baseline about, this is kind of where the doctor part plays in, about how our brains and bodies connect in order to help us understand and have that assessment internally of where we are and how we can leverage that information in order to help us perform better. So one thing to understand from a little bit of a physiologic perspective is that our bodies are constantly in a little bit of a balance between what in medicine we call the parasympathetic or the kind of rest and digest part of our nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system or the part of our nervous system that responds to high stress environments. I like to think about it, the parasympathetic, you're sitting at the beach, the sun is shining and there's a cool breeze. The sympathetic nervous system is all those parts of your body that are active when you're being chased by a mountain lion. Your heart rate goes up, your breathing gets faster, your palms might get sweaty, things like that. And if we get even a little bit more nerdy about that, we can look how that response happens in the brain. For those that can see the slides, it's a little bit of a schematic, but essentially there's a part of the brain that takes in information and it goes into what we call the thalamus. And that is a pretty quick pathway. And that part of the brain decides, is this something that is an immediate threat to my life? Do I need to just act? Or is this something that I can think about and process and then respond to? Once the kind of what we jokingly refer to as the lizard brain, the sympathetic or the I need to respond right now and I don't have time to think about it, part of the response gets activated, a lot of the peripheral parts of the brain don't get to have a vote. And our stress response will take over, which can be good in a life-threatening situation. But also we need to recognize that it is a part of our brain that acts so quickly that we don't always have conscious thought over. The next part of the body that we look at when we talk about a response is our heart rate. Being able to understand how our heart works. For those that can see the slide, you can see a piece of a strip of what we call heart rate variability. And on the top of the slide is a very fluid, easy on the eyes kind of line that shows you how our heart responds and is efficient when we are relaxed and in a slow state and our heart rate and our breathing are synchronized. On the bottom of the slide is a demonstration of our heart rate variability when we are under stress. And it is a jagged, inefficient, very kind of less natural way of responding. The good thing, and we'll talk about it later, is there are ways to help us do something about that and improve our stress response. And so in order to do that, we have to understand a little bit more about how the stress response works. When we talk about that heart rate getting elevated, when our sympathetic nervous system starts to kick in,
we start to lose control over those fine motor parts of our body. And there's some well-documented changes to the way that we respond in that stressful environment. Those that can see the slides can see a chart from the book called On Combat by Dave Grossman. And he uses a color-coded version to show us a little bit about the escalation of our body's response to stress and how we our ability to perform will respond. So we get a little bit stressed, maybe our heart rate's in the 90s, we start to lose a little bit of that fine motor control. When we get increasing amounts of stress, our complex motor skills start to decline. And then as we get into what he defines as the gray or the black, we really start to lose a lot of our cognition, our peripheral vision. We truly develop tunnel vision. Our depth perception gets off, which in skydiving can be a big issue. But we lose a lot of our near vision, and we start to get into what is commonly described as that fight, flight, freeze response, which isn't helpful in a high-risk environment, or really in most day-to-day environments as well. Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to talk about a couple of things really quickly there. The first one was in relationship to the way that the pathways work within the brain and moving from the thalamus straight to the amygdala, and how many times I've seen this in some of my base jumping experience. And like a beginner base jumper who's maybe making their first or second jump, they walk out onto the bridge and they move from being fully cognizant to like deer in the headlights, and they're totally gone. And all they're doing is operating straight out of that fear response of like high stress, no processing anymore. And you lose all of the depth of higher logic, and they go straight to, I got to execute. And all of the things that are like, you would think these things are like super simple, like, you know, just basic safety steps, like follow the 1, 2, 3, and they go out the window and they go straight from 1 to 3, and they go, you know, locked into this kind of survival pathway like you're talking about. So I wanted to kind of touch on that point a little bit more and hear maybe some reflections from you guys about your experiences with operating in that place and how it's affected you.
Yep. I know for me, looking at that chart there, you can see the somewhere between the red and the black on that color-coded chart is where I was not wearing a heart rate monitor at the time of my accident, but I imagine if I was, that's exactly where I would have been. Because you see the loss of motor control and then the loss of depth perception. So, you know, for non-skydivers at, you know, a certain altitude above the ground, you need to pull down your two steering toggles to level the parachute out and slow it down before you hit the ground. And that's somewhere between my eyes, my brain, and my arms, that signal didn't happen. And so I essentially hit the ground at full speed. And again, the only explanation that I can see looking at that chart and with the data, the medical science, is that like that signal just died somewhere based on the level of stress I was under. And it actually gave me a certain amount of closure, because for years I was like, how did this happen? I'm a good skydiver. I don't understand. And then when Megan showed me this and I actually saw the medical data, I'm like, oh, it makes sense now. And obviously that I wish I would have known all this years ago, but it actually was really cool to see that. And I see it as well as a free fall instructor with students. They will freeze and do nothing fairly often, mm-hmm. actually.
Mm-hmm.
This really gives us a tool as well. Something that I learned as well is this heart rate management skill, right? Of learning, I guess I got it from like martial arts early in life, of this idea of like, if you can control your breathing, if you can control your heart rate, then you can control your level of stress, your level of stimuli, and you can be like water, that Bruce Lee, they might be like water, like be super fluid and present and have the peripheral vision not get tunneled out to like that deer in the headlights experience. So I guess this points us towards how do we manage or mediate our heart rate in those challenging situations when we're feeling like our load is coming up? And do we notice that our heart rate and our breathing is increasing?
Yeah, I want to
soon enough to be able to do something to act against
it. I want to share a quick story just to illuminate this point also. Is early on in my vertical skydiving career, we're talking about flying head to earth, going, you know, 180, 200 miles an hour. That environment is highly stressful and it's a very aggressive environment. And when I was an early skydiver in that space, sort of young in that style of flying, I remember doing a like skills camp and I was fucking terrified, like really terrified. I still to this day am like vividly like back there in my mind's eye. It was so acute, the fear. And I didn't know enough then to go, even though I had thousands of skydives, I still didn't know then that level of acute fear was something that I needed to really look at and care about as relative to preparation. Instead, I went and I did the skydives and an incident occurred. What happened was I was on the skydive. I'm there, quote unquote, doing my job-ish. And at breakoff, because I was so scared, and breakoff, for those of you who are not skydivers listening, that's when you turn away from a formation and you leave and go open your parachute and clear airspace. I was so afraid and my flight response was so activated that I just turned really quickly and tried to escape, and I ended up colliding with another skydiver. I ended up hitting somebody. Luckily, both of us were fine. And that's one of those incidents where something really bad could have happened. And luckily, no one was hurt. But it really, really woke me up. And I was like, whoa, when I am that afraid, I need to check myself. And I probably need to just pause and figure out how to get that fear down to a level where I don't feel it so acutely. So anyway, I just wanted to share that because I feel like it's very relevant. But also, you can get to those places. I mean, again, we just did the vertical world record. We did 100 ways. And on those skydives, part of my experience was being in my slot and also being intentional about bringing calm and presence and peacefulness almost to the breakoff moment where I would normally be like, oh my God, get me out of here. I'm super, super scared, right?
That must have been really scary.
Well, yeah. So going back to Jay's question, I more just wanted to illuminate what you guys shared in another way, you know, through that kind of a share. But Megan, what would you say next about what's next?
How do we respond to stress, right? Like how this is all about the stress response, right?
Yeah. So, and for those that are not skydivers that are hearing these things, I would kind of point out that you don't have to be in the most perceived high stakes environment for these things to affect you. When we experience strong emotions, I know that Jay had a vulnerable share on one of the very recent podcasts about anger. And when we experience really strong emotions, we can get hijacked by our amygdala in a similar fashion. And the outside information just doesn't process, and we can't see beyond the things that our amygdala is trying to tell us, which is that fear and stress response. So it's really kind of applicable across the board, even if you're not a skydiver, a base jumper, or someone that's doing high risk activities. I can go into a little bit of some of the things that we can do to manage the stress response. So if we look back at that curve, and for those kind of following along, if we have increased stressors on the day-to-day,
we really decrease our zone of tolerance for when it comes to trying to achieve peak performance. Maybe you didn't sleep well. We'll talk about that in a minute. Maybe you got in an argument with someone. Any of those additional stressors really decrease our ability to not only perform, but also to tolerate additional amounts of stress. When we look at that, a framework that I really like is one we call cognitive bandwidth. Essentially thinking about our brains like the coax cables that might run into an old house with trying to bring internet. The computer that you've got 18 apps running in the background, the more you pile on, the more you take up of that bandwidth, the more processing slows down and the more information seems to have difficulty traveling. One of the things that I look at it is, for those that can't see the slides, it's a we look at kind of a conglomeration of those things that take up our bandwidth in order to perform, the technical skills, the environmental factors, the physical factors in our bodies, the cognitive factors in our brains, and kind of our baseline health. And when we look at those factors, we can start to sort out how do we really expand that bandwidth and give ourselves an improved ability to perform and tolerate stressors in day-to-day life. The first step, and this is something I'll certainly take a pause because I want to hear you guys' thoughts about this. I think it's probably one of the most important parts, is recognizing that we can do something about it. And having a growth mindset to believe that we can make change to the processes that are going on in our brain. We have to start to put an intentional effort into listening to our bodies and to looking at the ways that we approach each part of our life and how it contributes to our performance, but that we have the power to do something.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
I'm a huge believer.
Yeah. It's. I mean, as coaches, we know very well that if we become tuned into our physical state, our body's the indicator, right? Like, our body tells us everything that we need to know if only we're willing to listen and pay attention to what our body is saying. And a lot of the time, the changes in those environments are subtle, right? Our breathing might start to become slightly erratic or increased rate, or our heart rate might start to go up. We might start getting, you know, physical movement. Really common in my experience is I'll start to twitch and ed, like just move around a little bit. I start to become uncomfortable and I start demonstrating stress by these factors. And if we're able to note them, then we can take the preemptive steps. Just last week, I was flying my paraglider and it was a challenging day and I was getting to high altitude and the air was a little bit rough, and I noted that I was tensing up and then my breathing was becoming tight and I was starting to have a fear response, and I was moving from that logical, you know, broad thinking mind to that like tighter and tighter amygdala response, and thinking, and I noted the kind of like the erratic tight breathing. And then I'm like, well, wait a second, Jay. My action is to literally speak out loud. It's okay. Calm down. You're just take a breath. And then by triggering the change in the physiological body to say, okay, getting that breath in and having the intentional long exhale is actually empowering a change in the physiological state and putting me back into the ability to process, which now means I can do that again, which can push me a little further away from that reptile brain, a little further away from it. And so just simple breathing exercises are a great example of how to manage the physiological response. First thing is becoming aware of it.
Yeah. And what I would add, Megan, is believing we are capable is a massive, massive step in this process. Like, believing that we are not fixed, that we are actually capable, and growth is available to basically anyone who makes intentional effort toward it. That's a huge, huge thing. Because if we really don't believe that, of course nothing is going to ever change. Nothing, you know what I mean? We won't be able to access growth really unless it's accidental. But even still, fixed mindsets, it's tough, right? I mean, I have compassion for that too. You know what I mean? We all have, I think, struggles with that in our own ways and in the ways that we're aiming to work on our own stuff and yada, yada, yada. But yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing in my experience, like even in some of my like darkest times where I've been really heartbroken and just struggling and confused and all the things that you just don't want to feel. You know, I'm talking more about an emotional experience because I've never had a physical, knock on wood, physical accident, you know, but like I've had emotional, relational, quote unquote, incidents. You know what I mean? And so I think those are similar, right? And dealing with the stress responses that arise in those scenarios as well. So yeah,
I was just going back and forth, Mel, with this experience of having worked with so many students and seeing when the switch flips and we lose them and they're not there anymore. And then also I heard you bring it into like the emotional experience and I went, oh, and I saw the same switch flip inside of my relationships where we've gotten into an argument and all of a sudden the stress is there and click, and we're not the same person anymore. And we're operating out of that reptile brain kind of thinking in just a standing there. We were talking, it became elevated and then switch flipped and it was too stressful. And all of a sudden we're talking like monsters to each other because we're not able to process the higher bandwidth kind of stuff that we would normally very, very much want included in that conversation. Yeah. I see Eric's head bobbing up and down. Like he's like, yep, this.
Yep. Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure Megan will agree that in any relationship will happen, unfortunately, from time to time. It is a thing that I know for me, I'm trying to be a lot more aware of in my own life, like catching that and being like, uh-oh, I'm not acting like a reasonable human right now. But the unfortunate thing is sometimes we are not, once we're in that state, we are not always capable of catching ourselves. And sometimes we have to rely on the other person to recognize that. And we have to believe them when they tell us like, hey dude, you're not yourself right now. And then we have to have the humility to be like, they know me, they care about me. They're not trying to be mean or attack me. I need to listen. And that is very much a work in progress for myself.
A few weeks ago, we had a guest on the show named Joshua Wall, and he's also a veteran, and he was talking about how he was in this basically living in fight or flight all the time, you know, and his little girl would be like, Daddy, help me with this, and he would just fly off the handle at his, you know, loved little girl that he wanted to take care of, but unable to get out of that stress place and just operating from that in an environment where there's actually no stress present.
Yep.
Really insightful.
Yep.
It is. And we could probably skip ahead and touch on that because I think that what you're getting at is a really powerful thing in that, and we can kind of jump back to some of the other topics, but one of the things that I think is hugely important for building a baseline foundation of being able to impact these responses, like getting to kind of where the rubber meets the road. We talk about our bodies and our health and things like that, and we can come back to that. But I think that what you're bringing up to with the mind-body connection is absolutely instrumental. Being able to take those opportunities to ground ourselves, whether that be a useful tool of five senses. What are my five senses perceiving right now? What can I see? What can I hear? What can I smell? What's going on in my environment? How does that open up the aperture in the here and now? But the development of things like meditation or mindfulness practices or gratitude practices, cultivating connection,
and really being able to bring in that emotional and spiritual aspect. And then the part which you're hitting on, which I don't think can be even stressed enough, that I know that both Eric and I, and from what I've heard in a lot of the podcasts, brought up, that a lot of people experience is residue, right? The Body Keeps the Score is a great book that looks at that, but the ways that our body remembers the stressors that we've been in, and unless we take the space to process those things, they live inside it. And they stay with us, whether we're conscious of it or not. And that tends to amp up that sympathetic nervous system and keep it rolling all the time and reinforce those pathways as almost a constant. Yep. It's something that I experienced with the post-traumatic stress piece, and it's something I much identified with that podcast, is that piece of having difficulty really coming out of that red space. And I think it's a problem that a lot of veterans experience.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, for sure. Take us back to the fixed mindset versus growth mindset element and how we can make the decisions within our life experience about, you know, I can't do anything about this, or I can do something about this.
The sponsor of today's episode is Great Spirit Farm.
Yes.
Love having Great Spirit Farm with us, and specifically their ayahuasca microdose tincture. It is a natural MAOI antidepressant and anti-anxiety. Great Spirit Farm describes the feeling as a warm hug. It can help you access deep creativity, flow, intuition, and improve vivid dream recall, which actually has totally been my experience.
So what is exactly in the bottle is the ayahuasca vine itself. So this is a tincture extraction, double extraction tincture that contains the Banisteriopsis caapi vine. Now, the particular vine that this has been extracted from has been growing in Florida now for over 25 years. And the ayahuasca vine does not contain DMT, so that makes this tincture 100% legal in all 50 states.
Yeah, Great Spirit Farm recommends starting with 1 to 3 dropperfuls and increasing your dose gradually from there until you feel the effects. There are no known contradictions with antidepressants, and always check with your doctor and only take as directed.
And what's really great about what Great Spirit Farm is doing is they're making sure that 10% of all the sales are returned to the Shipibo tribe, honoring the medicine's indigenous roots with active reciprocity. Now, if you want to try this tincture out for yourself, you can go to the website. That is ayadose.com, ayadose.com. And you can enter our discount code TTJ10 to get 10% off your order. Again, that's ayadose.com and all caps TTJ10 to get 10% off your order.
I think that one of the most important points is realizing that we can. We can, and it's all about the story we tell ourselves, about recognizing that we can affect a huge amount of the things that are happening, that we can, that are, is not the world happening to us, it's us operating within the world. There's been a fair bit of research looking at it, and there's some really cool imaging out there. For those that can't see the slides, you can kind of Google some of this stuff. But for those that can, we've got an image of essentially brain cells and a neural network before you train any sort of activity. When you start to simulate those neural cells by doing a thing in your life, it starts to create these really beautiful webs of connection between the brain cells. And the phrase is, those that wire together, fire together. The things that we practice more and more, whether it be the way that we brush our teeth in the morning, the way that we flare a parachute, the way that we listen to our body and breathe, we reinforce those pathways. And you can see those neural networks after you stimulate similar neural networks for 2 months, those pathways just become increasingly robust. And I like to think about it almost like the way that we exercise the muscles in our body. You can exercise those neural pathways and really build them strong, build the way that we process and think about things, really build up the parasympathetic nervous system to be able to kind of come down when we needed to. And so the ways that we do that, first and foremost, is managing our overall health, getting good sleep, managing mental, emotional, spiritual wellness, eating well, exercising in some way, and really managing our nervous system. And I can kind of touch briefly on any of those things. The one that I would harp on probably the most is sleep. As a culture, we just really get not enough sleep. After we are awake for 24 hours is similar to having a blood alcohol content that would make it illegal to drive. And alcohol, on a side note, really affects our sleep. Even one alcoholic drink late in the evening can cause disruptions in the really, truly restful parts of our sleep. And sorry for those that really enjoy their alcoholic beverages. It doesn't mean we can't ever drink, but we just need to understand the way it affects us. But when it comes to sleep deprivation, it affects the reaction time and the thinking, our level of wakefulness, our mood, our memory, all aspects of our ability to really perform in the environment are affected by our sleep.
I'm obsessed with my sleep data on my Oura Ring. My tracking, it's like I really enjoy looking at it. It's fascinating. Seeing how much REM sleep. My REM went up like crazy over the last like 4 months or 5 months. Super strange, totally an aside, but it's only to illuminate how obsessed I am with my sleep data and how much I look at it.
Go ahead.
And I also,
I'm gonna go ahead and throw it out there, Oura Ring, if you're listening, we would love to have some
rings
to track, because I would be all about paying attention to that. And I can't sleep with my watch. It's too much. So Oura Ring sounds like a perfect sponsor for the show.
Does sound like a perfect sponsor for the show. I like where your head's at, Jay. Perfect.
Yeah.
I used to actually feel, once I really got, I used to say stuff like, oh, I'll sleep when I'm dead, right? Just like, I want to be in life. I want to be living. I want to da-da-da and intensity and this and that. And that used to 100% be me until I had some whatever bigger challenges in life and growth and all those things, yada, yada. If you listen to the podcast, you know the stories. Super condensing it for our sakes today. But then I realized and I got, whoa, I am so much more emotionally fragile. I could notably see my cognitive performance go down as a writer, as a public speaker, stuff like that. When I didn't sleep well or when I didn't sleep enough, it was so obvious that I then was like, I flipped and was like, sleep is number one, primo, critical. If I'm going on a big demo jump or I have a record, I am really committed to. And yeah, this is, of course, you have to also have it without detachment. I can't be like freaking out if I didn't sleep enough, but I had to go through that too, where I was very attached. I got to sleep at this time. And then I had a bunch of sleep anxiety when I didn't get to go to sleep. And then I was like, okay, I got to. So it's almost another relationship to stress and understanding how you're going to perform.
I just went through the same thing, Mel, with feeling very triggered around schedule imposing on my sleep schedule and being very resistant and aggravated by a fixed schedule that was really going to impact how much sleep I was getting. And what was interesting about it was how I wasn't as flexible as I wanted to be. I wanted to be able to go to sleep earlier and still get the sleep I needed, but I knew that wasn't going to work. I'm not going to go to sleep at 8 o'clock at night. It's not going to happen unless I were to get up, you know, really, really early the day before or something. Regardless, there's a point I want to bring up here before I hand the mic back over. And that is, there's this perception that we have when we're younger that we are very resilient and very elastic and that we can give up sleep and that we don't really lose that much performance. Like, we're okay. I'll get by. I'll be all right. And when we get older, we recognize that like emotional inflexibility or how we tend to be sharp or very, very inflexible. We're not as resilient as we get a little older. We're more in tune with it. But I think that we're really lying to ourselves when we're younger that that's not also the case, right? We may have the physical stamina to push through 24 hours or 36 hours or 48 hours of being awake. And I know Eric's probably, and Megan, you can both relate to this, of this, like, I'm on duty right now. I need to be present and active. And the physical body will be upright and doing what it needs to be doing. But all these higher level processes are fading away and we're not really able to access or leverage them when they're needed. Then when the pressure really comes on because a true stress situation is occurring, we're not responding anywhere close to our normal level, or even our top potential isn't even in the game. Our normal level is not happening. We're somewhere down, you know, half below where we might normally yep. be. Megan, please go ahead. Take us there. Yeah.
Oh, it's all 100% spot on. And Mo, what you were saying about the change in REM sleep makes absolute sense. I know very recently you were talking about how with certain projects wrapping up, you were kind of stepping away, and all of that absolutely makes sense in what we know about sleep and the REM sleep changes when we're under stress. It completely
wow.
does. It's perfectly aligned. Our bodies are just kind of a fascinating entity that we really truly, it's predictable and it makes sense, but we know so little about, I think, sometimes. And it's interesting what you said about feeling like that I'll sleep when I'm dead. And I think a lot of us felt that way when we were young. And the sad part about it is the data would say that if we take that mindset, we will die sooner. Yep. And we will have the time that we're alive will be less pleasant. Because our mood will be less happy and our lifespan will truly be shorter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a bunch of sleep studies that are proving in recent years that the quality of our sleep is a huge factor in the total quality of our life and the length of our life.
Absolutely. Good sleep is good for us.
For sure. Let's jump into the next section. Yeah.
So moving on a little bit about some of the other things that we can do. I touched a bit on the emotional and spiritual things that we can do that can help support our wellness and support our nervous system. And there's a fair bit of neuroscience behind that. Essentially, that mindfulness practice or grounding practice can actually make the parts of the brain that respond in that slow, I'm making a decision pathway, the frontal cortex, gets more robust when we have a mindfulness practice, when we practice gratitude. And the amygdala, the part that hijacks us and makes everything shut down, actually become smaller. And they've shown that in various different functional MRI studies, just how truly those neural networks, the actual anatomy changes when we change our behavior.
You're saying that the brain size, the different components of the brain size actually change because of mindfulness practice?
There's evidence to that effect, yes. So awesome. Just like our muscles can hypertrophy, we can and shrink if we don't use them, the brain responds in a similar fashion.
Amazing.
It's pretty cool. At least I think so too.
Yeah, I think so. I'm gonna exercise that part.
Yeah, like it's encouraging. Yep. You know what I mean? Because again, for somebody who feels like they have high stress response, they're in anxiety all the time, they're feeling fear or they're feeling triggerable very easily, it is a wonderful thing to hear, to know that you can actually do things to help yourself. You know what I mean? Like, that's a big deal. It really is. I mean,
it's not cool to be walking around with a big amygdala.
Right.
Right.
It makes me want it. That piece of information, I'm not joking, Megan, that feels like an actual motivator to me to meditate more. And I believe in meditation, too. But I'm like, ooh, that for some reason, for me, hearing that piece of science, like data, I'm just like, oh man, heck yeah. Then I'll lay down and close my eyes and do it for 30
super
minutes.
Super interesting. This morning I had my Muse meditation device, which is a brain scanner, which tells you which parts of what type of brain waves you're focused in. I had it and I was like, you know, the whole purpose of this thing is to give us real world feedback about how effective our meditation practice is. And so through the use of a device like that, which is pretty simple, it just gives you a readout on your phone. It's got a live feedback. So the way that it works is you put on a Bluetooth headset or headphones and you put on the device and it wraps around your forehead and it reads the brainwaves. And when you're meditating, if your brain is in an overly active state, or which what I'm going to imagine is probably in the amygdala, it is giving you these sounds like rain and thunder, where there's noise in the background. And if your brain is in a peaceful, like open theta wave kind of thinking, it gives you the sounds of birds chirping. So it's live feedback to help know whether we're in the right mind frame or not, to actually be in the brain waves we're looking to target during meditation. And for me, I'm a very data driven guy. I can't, if I don't know what I'm doing, I get super frustrated right away. I'll be like, fuck this. I'm not going to bother doing this anymore. I don't know if it's working or not. I don't know if I'm doing it right. Am I wasting my time doing this exercise? I don't know if I'm executing it well. Then I don't know if I'm hitting the target muscle that I'm trying to target. Then I'll lose patience with it. So knowing that there's a relationship between what part of the brain I'm trying to train, and knowing that there are actual tools out there that can tell us whether you're hitting or not, just like if you're into bodybuilding, you can put a sensor on the muscle and you can work that muscle and you can measure the amount of feedback that the muscle's getting. You can put the sensor on your head and you can measure the amount of feedback that you're getting in the brain waves there.
So I want to invite Eric back into the conversation, because I know you've been, I want to hear about your experience with these things that assist. You know, what was your experience as after your accident, or just tell us more how what worked for you and what you employed in this list of things that can help us.
That's a whole other podcast right there. My whole journey through all of this. But you know, I think it's, I am very lucky that I had some systems in place, before this accident, because I was in a pretty bad place, both physically from being injured, but also just in my life in general at the time. You know, as previously mentioned, I'd done multiple deployments and was kind of coming to the end of my operational deployable time, just based on, you know, my rank. I was moving into a more kind of desk leadership type role that I was not really happy about. I was feeling kind of useless, kind of helpless, and like I wasn't able to contribute in a way that I wanted to. So I was already dealing with some depression and frustration, and then this injury on top of it. You know, I was drinking a lot, was not coping with things in the best possible way. But I had, thankfully, I had a meditation practice, and I had some mental health professionals at work that were kind of able to help me process through some of this. And I think those things, along with the support of people that cared about me, helped me push through the worst of it. Because there was a point initially after my injury where I was concerned I might not be able to jump again. I might not be able to do, you know, anything that I like doing again. And it scares me to think where that might have led me if I didn't have some of these things to fall back on to help pull me out of it. But the meditation was a big part of it. It's kind mm-hmm. of that, was it Viktor Frankl, the like between stimulus and response, there's the choice about how you're going to deal with any situation. And that is a thing that I've tried to focus a lot on over the years, because through combat deployments or just life in general, like, you don't always get to choose what happens to you. You can't always, you know, but you can most of the time choose how you're going to deal with it. And that's ultimately where we find the power, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that's your only saving lifeline in some situations, unfortunately, when you have no control about anything else.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Eric, for sharing that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Megan, go ahead. Take us to the next section. Or continue sure. this section, whatever's next, basically, because no, I don't know the order. So yeah, take us to whatever's next.
No, I wanted to touch really quickly on what Jay had just said about data and being a person that really needs to see it. And I have to admit that I was stubborn when it came to learning about a lot of this stuff or believing it. And the data part of this is what kind of opened my eyes and made me want to share it with other people, because it, for example, I myself didn't understand the effect that all of the stressors in my life was having on me until I had a sleep study and my heart rate was in the 90s, which is very abnormal, for hours on end while I was perceivably sleeping. And then I was able to do a program where we had a heart rate monitor on and did those breathing exercises, and I could watch my own heart rate variability improve on the screen. And for those that don't have the fancy neuromonitoring that Jay has, the simple technology exists in your Apple Watch, and I would guess in your Oura Ring. Here's the Oura plug again. A lot of these technologies will track heart rate variability, which is at least a more simplified way of looking at it and an end sight thing you can follow. And I have watched my own heart rate variability, just because I'm an Apple Watch owner, watched it improve as I've really started a lot of these practices, really grown it, and then seen the improvement in my mood and the way I feel and the way I'm performing day to day. So it really is, some of these things are really hard to quantify, but it's real, as best as I can say it. And the things that we can do on a physical aspect, when we talk about hydration, there's evidence that we perform better when we're nourished and hydrated well, when we treat our bodies well, when we're conditioned, and when we manage pain well. I think a lot of us have aches and pains on the day-to-day, especially as I've gained a birthday or two. I started to wake up and be like, man, can't get out of bed without feeling this or that. The more we manage those things, the more bandwidth that we free up for performance. So trying to bring to the forefront of our attention all of those little things that are nagging in the background when we get ready to do a task that requires our focused attention. We like to think, oh, I'll grab lunch later, or I'll do this or that later. And those things are kind of reeling in the background, like open apps. So the more that we can close those apps out, the more that we can be present to the things that are occurring in our immediate need. And we can practice those skills too. So there are, again, really good data about the fact that we can utilize some of the brain training apps to help our brain get used to staying on a task for longer periods of time. Another thing we can do when we talk about closing down the apps in the background is to recognize that every single decision we make each day is a cognitive load. And the more decisions we make, the more it affects our ability to think in the present moment. In the medical world, they actually looked at doctors' prescribing habits. And they found that physicians prescribe more later in the day because they're so tired from making the decision and from having conversations about what is needed or what is not needed, that you're actually seeing an increase in that. And we see it every day. I don't know about you, but when I get ready to make a decision about what's for dinner, it's just like, I'm exhausted.
Yep. Very normal.
Yeah, so it's so much easier to make that impulse to go grab some takeout when we just don't feel the energy to do it, right? And it's
absolutely. And so when pathways. We're trying to operate in a high-risk environment, that's even more important. So when it comes to anything that could put our life at risk, from flying a parachute to driving our car or motorcycle on the highway, the more we can intentionally remove unnecessary decisions or minimize the amount of decisions we have to make in a day, the more bandwidth we open up for being in the present.
Yep. I'm a huge fan of the Steve Jobs wear the black shirt and jeans basic thing. I'm serious. It's sort of my go-to outfit if I'm trying to limit decisions, is it just a black shirt and jeans and that's it. Which sounds silly, but it's one little thing that actually does help.
I could just think about how quickly you're trying to get out the door, right? Like if you're in a hurry and you got to get to something on time, if you just say default on a decision and you don't have to make mental pathway, you don't burn out that, because the way the pathways actually work in the brain is they literally can only run a signal for so long before the signaling process starts to degrade. Like, it's like running an engine too hot for too long. Eventually, it doesn't want to work as well. You got to keep an engine cool. You've got to keep it lubricated. You got to keep all the systems in play. And our brains operate in a very similar fashion. I notice, and so the one that immediately came to mind for me is, I love to climb mountains. I love to go do high adventure sports. And I know if it's going to take me 8, 12, 14 hours to get to the top of the mountain, and then I'm planning to fly or jump back down, am I going to have enough mental bandwidth due to how much fatigue has occurred both physically and mentally to have reached that point to be able to then execute the flight back down with enough margin for error to account for what I'm, and it's a very big question, you know? I've had the dehydration piece very in my foreground of like, I've been out of water for a long time and now I'm getting near high pressure. It's time to exit. It's time to launch. I know this is effectively, I'm seeing my becoming short tempered. I'm seeing that I'm being aggravated with my physical movements. I'm seeing how it's playing into the bigger picture. And I still have to then either decide, am I going to fly or am I going to 14-hour walk back down, you know, those, either way, something's going to have to happen. But so having these skill sets, this is the point, is having the skill set to employ, to first recognize the state of the physical body, like putting more and more and more attention on how we're feeling, what's my body trying to tell me that it needs right now. And even if I can't give it what it needs, what can I do? What else can I give it to help take the body out of those high stress environment, high stress situations, and calm it back down enough to be able to make the decisions that need to be made at the time. Megan, I know you've got an answer for me. I want to go ahead and jump right back in here.
No, you're spot on. And that it's that controlling what we can control, and it's the insight there is huge. So I'll touch a little bit just the last kind of pillar that comes to my mind is the environmental piece and recognizing the environment that we're in and its impact on our body as well. So how hot or cold it is. Jay, you talked about all of that sensory input with your hearing all of the technology when you were flying the paragliding and trying to process that sensory input, the how bright it is and how noxious that stimuli is to our brain, and then the sense of smell. And we can actually leverage those things in our environment if we have control of them to help us calm as well. So getting to a cool, comfortable place, dimming the lights, utilizing aromatherapies to really kind of bring the nervous system to a state of calm. So I, in my mind, keep this kind of in the back of my mind, break glass in case of emergency feeling of a list of things for me that work to help me if I have the insight. And this is a little bit different for every person, but as I've developed these tools, I've started to keep a list of things that help me once I've recognized it to manage whatever I'm feeling. So if I'm starting to feel exhausted and fatigued, and I can feel things ramping down, but I really need to perform in the moment, I'll start to utilize things. Caffeine is the easy go-to button. It's something to be careful of because the half-life of caffeine or the amount of time that it stays active in our system is really a lot longer than we often feel it active, and it will affect our sleep. I'll be really careful about keeping the cognitive task absolutely what's necessary here and now. Other things like chewing ice chips can bring us into that sensory piece of the moment. I love to dance. I'll use music or get out in the sunlight and nature. A little bit of body weight exercise. I'll stand up and do squats next to my desk just to like kind of get the blood flowing. And things like citrus scents can really wake you up and pull you in if you're starting to kind of get to that kind of feeling and it's time to kick it back into overdrive.
It's super awesome to hear how you're tying these pieces together. Recently, I've been doing these power yoga classes that are really intense. And at the end of the class, the instructor draws, as we try to bring our stimulus level back down, the instructor draws all the curtains to darken the room. And then as everybody lays down for a moment of rest, they walk around with a Palo Santo, incense that's burning a very aromatic smoke, which is very calming. So we've got the aromatherapy side of it and the darkening of the light intensity, and both of those things are helping to return the body to like a more homeostasis type of status. Yeah,
and there's definitely some additional things you can add to that list. So you talked about breath work when we talk about getting out of the red or getting out of that stress state. The out breath is the part of the breath that really starts to trigger the parasympathetic, that rest part of our nervous system. So for years, various special operations forces have used the four, what they call box breathing. Breathe in for four, hold it for four, exhale for four, and then another hold for four. And that works really well. The other thing you can do is lengthen that out breath even longer. And there's a couple of apps I have for those that take a look at the slides whenever you do that I've found helpful for me, that you can actually train some of that breath work. The one in the image here that has the little waveform, it's called iBreathe. It is one tool. It's not the only tool, but you can actually, it has like a little metronome where you can manage your breath and practice breathing. And I've noticed a change in my heart rate as I've done that. Some of the other things, again, like yoga, as Jay talked about, soft red lights, lavender scents, eating something, because often when we're stressed, we don't eat.
and hydrating. Those kind of things are on the list of things that you can do, keep in a toolbox of, hey, I need to come out of the red. What can I do next? And what are some simple, quick fixes? And for those that are following along, there's a huge amount of resources out there as far as being able to practice these things. The Huberman Lab podcast is excellent. The Mission Critical Team Institute and the Uniformed Services University research page. A lot of those things have a lot of really helpful science-driven information about even more in-depth. And there's a list of books and apps and things. And if anybody wants to hit me up, I think y'all are putting my, we can put my, the socials out there. I love, this is something I'm super passionate about and just will nerd out about at any point.
Like, this is fantastic. You know, there's so many things that you bring up in this share that I have as part of my daily and life practices that I may or may not be consciously aware of how they're affecting. One of the ones that just really pops up for me and I'm like, oh, wow, look at that. Here it is there, here it is there, here it is over there, is this whole sense of scent piece and how that affects us. And how we may not be present to that. So much of our time, we're not, it's not like our eyes where we're constantly, we can't shut our nose off and we can't shut our eyes off, you know, like they're on all the time. Our ears are on all the time. That sense of smell, whether it's in the yoga environment of like burning some incense to calm and create a sense of safety and relaxation, or whether it's like a smelling salts, kind of like a whiff of something to like invigorate, to stimulate at the gym before doing a big lift. Or what I saw a friend do a little while ago, and that just, this is why it popped up, is they had a little vial of essential oil, a little mini vial in their little pouch, or like, and took a moment and pulled it out and just took a few sniffs out of the vial to like set their conscious energetic state of being before speaking to a crowd. Right? Like they're about to step up on stage and they just took out the vial and went, took a long deep inhale. And all of a sudden the whole physical body just changes the state that it's in. And they're able to then engage the group in a state of relaxation. And I immediately take that and I'm like, hey, mom, who's got six kids going crazy, like put a little vial of essential oil in your bag to help you de-stress. To be able to have just a tool. It looks like she's got, yeah, Megan's got one in her hand right now. It's literally the tools we can put in our pockets, right? It's a tool. I can just have it there. I can lean on it when I need it. And it's not like a cigarette or a drink. It's actually a tool, not a coping device, right? Huge difference.
Love it. I am with you, Megan, that I could nerd out forever on all this stuff. It's like fantastic. Eric, is there anything else that you want to add to the conversation? Are we coming into the close soon? Where are we with how much more do you think we have? I want to be mindful of your time and.
Go ahead,
Eric.
Well, I was going to say, time-wise, I have all kinds of time for this conversation, so that's kind of on you guys. But yeah, as far as Megan with the presentation, go ahead.
No, same. I can nerd about this at any until it all ends, but that's what I had as a condensed presentation that I had shared previously and kind of what I... the way that I frame it in a simplified, I guess, version to share with the group, I will say that Jay's right. Yeah, I carry these little essential oils around, and it's all about finding the tools that work for us and utilizing those little tools that help us chip away at whatever the issue is at the time, or to be able to stack them up and help us perform optimally in any situation. And recognizing that each little piece of the puzzle starts to eventually add up to the big picture. So any of those little things that we think, oh, this doesn't matter, or that doesn't matter, all of a sudden really makes a big picture. And that incorporating these into our daily lives as a practice is really how we start to build that capacity to do these great things. The things that we practice with intention, whether it's a closed eye repetition or a actual repetition in the thing that we're doing, really starts to reinforce those neural pathways and to help us build those habits that will help us really carry through in with intention going forward.
Yeah, I love how pragmatic a lot of your sharing is, you know, because we can be really high level meta existential on this show. And it's nice to really, and thank you for bringing stuff that really people can take home and start today. That's like so valuable, especially when we're, you know, managing a challenge, but to your point too, wanting to do better in something that we're maybe unsure how to lift ourselves up. Like, I feel like everything that you shared is all in service to that.
Something that's really, really hitting the money on the head for me, hitting the nail on the head for me is, lately I'm really coming into this awareness of needing to have a set of tools, a path, and a set of practices, that I need all three of these pieces in order to uphold my own mental, physical, and spiritual health journey, right? So the tools, meditation, caffeine, aromatherapy, scents, sunlight, breathing exercises. These are all tools, right? Practices, going out in nature on a regular basis, exercising regularly, meditating regularly, yoga, moving the body. These two sides of the coin, tools and practices, and then the path. I like thinking this idea of the path of like the spiritual path, right? And one of the big things that we as a culture are missing, and what has gone away for a lot of us, is this connection to spirit, this deeper part of like, how am I? How am I deeply connected to myself? What's my own real deep connection in here to the soul's journey? And so that path piece of connecting the physical and the mental to the soul to really feel whole in the whole experience, and recognizing that, yeah, some of it's just simple tools. I take this compound and it helps me to feel better. Caffeine, maybe. Wake me up, give me this cup of coffee right here. And some of them are practices like just sitting there and watching my own thoughts ping pong around inside my crazy room. And then some of them is just going, hey, just look at all this going on. Just being part of this path. I'm loving it. I want to thank you guys for coming to the show, Eric and Megan. This has been a fantastic time spent. Really appreciate you both making the time. Is there anything else that either of you would like to share or touch on, or where can people reach you if they want to reach out and talk? Tell us any more that you want to share.
So people can reach me on Instagram and Facebook with just my first and last name. And I do want to put it out there that if anybody has any need to talk about any of this, or is looking for more resources, or just wants to talk, the part of the reason that I think that I have made it to a little bit of a better place and learned about these tools is because a person that didn't know me very well was willing to really give me the space to be human and recognize that it was okay to be having trouble with these things. So I just, to anybody that might be having challenges with pieces of any of this, like, there are people out there that are just like you, and you don't have to be alone.
I love that. I love that. Thank you so much, Megan, for that. Eric, any final thoughts?
Yeah. Kind of along those same lines, and I actually talked to Jay a little bit about this. we were at the canopy piloting training. But one of my intentions for this year is being a lot more open about my own struggles, kind of coming home from deployment and war, as we said in the intro, where, yes, I've been home for a couple years now from my last deployments, but I feel like mentally, spiritually, emotionally, some part of me is still over there. And I know I'm not alone in that. There's a lot of folks that gave, you know, for me, it was all of my 20s and most of my, you know, early 30s. You know, you see a lot of bad things happen. You see a lot of very difficult things to process. And then you come back to this normal world where it seems like nobody really cares and nobody really knows. And it's a very difficult thing to be alone with. And this year I've felt very called to, one, try to feel less alone myself, but also to go out of my way to help others feel less alone. And so that's really... something I feel very strongly called to. I've lost a couple friends to suicide, a couple veteran friends in the recent months, and I had another close call with a friend that he afterwards even came up to me and said, like, "Hey man, if it weren't for you sharing the things that you were sharing and saying the things that you were saying, that made me realize that I'm not alone. Like, I don't know if I'd still be here." And so that made me really realize how important it is to not suffer in silence. Unfortunately, that's a slogan in the military. That's like a badge of honor, like suffer in silence, like man up, you know? And like that works in some circumstances, you know, on deployment, when you're doing the thing, like you're in the middle of a mission, like, yeah, suffer in silence, get the job done. But then when you come back and you're trying to live your life and be with the people that you care about and have a meaningful life afterwards, you can't suffer in silence. Like, you need help, whether that's just with your family or professionals or other brothers and sisters in arms or just caring strangers. Like, you need help. You need to find other people to lean on. So I just really want to encourage people to do that in whatever way feels okay to you. And I have a few things other resources I can put in the bio at the end as well.
Yeah, I love where you're going with this, Eric. It's very powerful. Thank you very much for that vulnerable share. The amount of my friends that I've seen come home and they can't get out of the red. This whole idea of like being stuck in the red and needing these tools and needing these practices and needing the community and needing the connection in order to be able to help pull down that stimuli, that constant stress level that's in place is so absolutely necessary. And I really am grateful for both of you doing this work of sharing the experience and learning, teaching what you've learned about how to actually be aware of our own state of being, and then sharing tools about how to manage and mediate that, as well as the recognizing the triggers that are in place. All this, man, I can't think of so many of my friends who have been in the exact same places as you're describing. Yeah. So,
and I just want to share one last thing too. I acknowledge you both also. Yeah, Megan, back to your share about the person that was there for you when you needed help, when you didn't maybe even know you needed help, but they showed up for you. They opened their heart to you. They opened their ear to you. That is just so powerful, to both acknowledge those people in our lives like you just did and be inspired by their example to become one, which you are clearly doing. And Eric, same to you. Like, that very much applies to you also, where you're like really bravely stepping out of a cultural narrative and a dictated way of being into something that is brave in a new way and it's helping a lot of people. So thank you both so, so much.
Yeah. And one final thank you to you guys specifically, because on one of my, it was actually one of my last deployments to Afghanistan, I randomly stumbled across this podcast as I was searching for skydiving podcasts. And so, you know, I think 2018 maybe, but a lot of the things that you guys talked about helped set the foundation for me to start exploring that there was a better way to deal with some of these problems other than just drinking and ignoring them, which is what I was currently doing at the time. So I want to thank you guys for all the work that you've done over the years and what you guys do to help people along their own paths in life, whatever they may be.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. We've definitely all been there. I've certainly had that bottle to my lips more times than it was ever near healthy to for me as well. So thank you for saying so.
Feeling the feels.
Yeah, lots of watery eyes in the end of the episode.
Wait,
yeah,
are there onions like, around? Ooh. What's happening? You guys, that we cannot thank you enough, really. I mean, we could just go on. And I, again, thank you so much for bringing your expertise, your heart, and yourselves to us and to everyone listening.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, seriously, for listening, for spending your valuable, valuable time, energy, and heart with us. Every bit of it makes a difference.
Yeah, thank you. We would love it if you could show your support for the show by subscribing on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, or follow us on Instagram. You can always click the like button, leave us a comment, or share an episode with somebody directly.
Like we mentioned, every month we host integration coaching circles. So, so much good work is happening there. You are invited to join us. Go to trustthejourney.today/integration. The Trust the Journey family includes these integration coaching circles and our private Facebook group where we connect and support each other. Join us by going to our website, trustthejourney.today, and click the orange Patreon button.
Yeah, thanks. It's your support and engagement that make the show possible. Thank you. We're here to connect with you. Feel free to DM us anytime on Instagram. We're at trustthejourney.today. Thank you. We love you.
We love you.
Keep laughing, keep loving, and keep trusting the journey.